Welcome to the Pause Purpose Play podcast with me, clinical psychologist Michaela Thomas. This podcast is for you if you're an ambitious working woman wanting to create more impact in the world with less impact on yourself. This is where we let go of the pressure of perfection for more joy, compassion, and connection in your life, so you can burn bright, not burn out. Hi, and welcome back to the Pause Purpose Play podcast with me, your host, Michaela Thomas, expert on all things perfectionism, connection, and compassion. Did you notice that I added another thing? I normally just say a couple of things, but today I'm feeling quite playful, so I added in connection as well. Because in this episode, I interviewed a really hilarious guest. Emily Jane Clark is someone who I've connected with on Instagram a long time ago, and her first book, Sleep is for the Weak, was something that got me through how my own child was refusing sleep when he was little. In this episode, we talk a lot about humour. We talk about the difference between using humour as a coping strategy to help us process and distance ourselves from the difficult things, taking the edge out of the pain and helping us to let go and move on from something hard. And then differentiating that from when humour becomes an avoidance strategy, when it's not helping us to process and we're actually needing to just have a good cry instead. Emily Jane and I reverently talked about how humour shows up and how we can use it to connect more deeply with other people through shared laughter and knowing that we're no longer as alone in our experience because we've been vulnerable enough to share what we're going through with someone else. You will also hear a bit more about Emily Jane's experience of mental health problems, specifically postnatal depression, anxiety, and OCD. So if you are someone who struggles with OCD, listen to the end of the episode and I'll pop in some more support services that can help you as well. But now let's introduce my guest. Emily Jane is a comedy TV writer who's written things for MASH Report, Mock the Week, The Jonathan Ross Show, and she's an author. She's written the book Sleep is for the Weak, which is about how to survive when your baby won't go the F to sleep. And that was an Amazon bestseller. She's written her second book, which is her first funny children's book, called The Beast of Knobbly Bottom, Attack of the Vampire Sheep. And that came out in July this year. So let's dive in. So welcome to the podcast, Emily Jane. It's really nice to have you here. And knowing now that I'm not allowed to call you Emily for a very funny reason, I think that it's going to be a delightful episode where we're going to talk a lot about humour and how we use a bit of gentle piss-taking to also deal with and manage the harder, darker things in life as well. So welcome to the episode.
Thank you for having me, Michaela.
We've connected on Instagram and kind of kept in touch for a while, and then I just find your stuff so hilarious. You are a very funny author and I can't wait to read your latest book as well. So tell me a little bit more first, starting from there, of like writing and being an author. Like, what does that mean to you?
I was always a writer. I was a journalist beforehand and a feature writer before I had children, funnily enough. But I always sort of dreamt of one day writing a book, writing scripts and things like that. So as much as I like journalism, it was always going to be just a way of getting into writing. But it just didn't kind of work out the way. Once you get started going on a certain path, it's really hard to sort of change. And unbelievably, this was sort of in my 20s before I had children, I thought I didn't have enough time to write a book. You know, I had entire weekends, just me, sat there. I had evenings to myself, yet I didn't have time to write anything else other than my work that I did during the day. But when I had children and had my eldest, I planned to go back to work. By this time, I was freelancing for various sort of magazines and places just regionally. And I said, after 6 weeks, I'll have this baby and then I can do some work from home. It'd be fine. 6 weeks, obviously, after I had the baby, I was still in my pajamas, pretty much crying into my coffee. I had to ring up all my clients and say, oh God, I think I'm going to need 6 months for this. And then 6 months came and I was still kind of crying into my coffee. But obviously, by then I had been diagnosed with postnatal depression. So, but I think even had I not had postnatal depression, I still would not have had the brain power to go back to work after 6 weeks. What was I thinking? I was, you know, getting no sleep. And then I had another baby really soon after. So I was sort of forced to take a bit of time out. And it was really stressful because I had no money. My partner at the time obviously had a job, but it was literally just covering our bills. But I just had no choice because I was actually at this point trying to write from home and look after sort of babies, and I was making myself really ill. So I just thought, you know, I'll just have to be skint. Something has to give. And it was a really dark time because I'd never sort of not earned money. We had to use the food banks because we were really struggling. And as I think I've probably mentioned to you before, my children didn't sleep. So I was very tired. But yeah, from that, weirdly, I started sort of writing things down, doing a bit of a blog just to get myself. This was after I was feeling better from the postnatal depression. So by the time my youngest was about sort of 9 months or something, just started scribbling things down on a blog. Yeah. And then that's when my whole career went in a very different direction, I think. So I was writing funny things down, weirdly, out of this dark place. I just remember sort of collapsing on the floor one day after I said I love you to the postman by accident. Now you might be thinking, how the hell does anyone do that? But he gave me a parcel, and instead of saying thank you, I said, oh, I love you. But the worst thing was I'd already done it the week before, same postman, lovely postman called Mark, but I didn't love him. So I was like, once he could forgive, the second time, bit dodgy. And I think I just sat down on the floor and started crying, and then I must have looked like a psychopath. Then it turned into like a big belly laugh. I just thought the whole thing was so ridiculous. I'd barely been leaving the house. Everything had kind of gone I'm so rubbish at not swearing. I can't think of another word for shit. So everything had gone pear-shaped. It was not what I expected from motherhood at all. And yeah, so I just started laughing and then just seeing the ridiculousness of the whole thing. So then I thought, you know, I'll carry on writing all this stuff down. I managed to get a book deal, and then that got me into comedy writing. And that was a really long story. I'm so sorry, Michaela. That's probably taken up the whole podcast.
Not at all, not at all. And I'm laughing with you because Sleep is for the Weak, your first book, is something that I really resonated with when my first child didn't sleep. Or, you know, to save his life. And I think I'm laughing with you because that sense of saying I love you to the postman or opening the door with a boo bow and all these things that we hear, these stories, they're funny because they're true, and they're not funny because they're sad, because it's to do with our postnatal depletion, how unsupported we are as mothers, how much we're expected to juggle. But I can laugh with you because I know how that sense of utter and nonsense can come to us when we're sleep deprived. And I remember sending stuff around Sleep is for the Week to my best friend, whose child also was a sleeper sister. And that sense of humor, being able to laugh about it, it knows no end, the positivity from that.
Yeah, that's true. And it's a great way, like you said, you were sort of sending things to other friends who had, I was connecting with people through the book and through the blog. And that made me feel better that we could, when you can laugh with other people, you feel sort of less insane as well. Yeah, so it's a real good connector, I think. It connects people and just keeps you sane, I think, through that time.
And your story is a very similar one, although the content is very different. The process is similar to a lot of the guests I've interviewed, whose purpose and impact in the world has actually come from quite a dark place. And it's not an upward trajectory of like, oh, I was in the down in the dumps and now I did this X thing and now I'm like on rags to riches. Like, life is still obviously hard. You're still juggling kids and, you know, just having released another book. So it is hard, but it's that sense of turning darkness into purpose. How did you do that?
I guess it was sort of sink or swim, really, because if you'd told me back then, when I was sort of in the middle of the night walking the hall with the baby, you know, not getting sleep, that one day I would actually have published a couple of books and written for TV because of this time, I just never would have believed it. And like you say, it's not just a straight rags to riches. Well, I wish it was riches. It doesn't really work like that, as you know from books. It's not like suddenly you're down and suddenly everything's okay. It's sort of a real up and down. And sometimes you take one step forward, five steps back, just as you think everything's okay. It's not again. And you're like, why am I even trying this? This is ridiculous, especially sort of with writing and books. As you know, there's kind of a lot of setbacks and a lot of rejections and things like that. So it wasn't all suddenly it was all okay. And it took sort of, you know, years of sort of groundwork and just finding other stuff in between. But that was my sort of light at the end of the tunnel, just this hope that something good would come from this stuff and could perhaps help other people in that position who, you know, with the sleep deprivation or the postnatal depression or just the whole thing of adjusting to motherhood and, like you were saying, what's expected of us.
And the lie that we get told, you kind of talk about that as well. What is the lie that we get told about motherhood?
For me, the most annoying one is that you can do it all. Motherhood didn't, especially at the time my kids were small. It was very much before the rise of the anti-perfect mum thing. Obviously, there's a lot of great people out there now who have uncovered this lie. But at the time, it really was all the sort of blogs and things you could find and sort of social media accounts tended to be the sort of yummy mummy type thing. You'd get people making baby food recipes. Yeah, and so that to me was the lie. And at the same time, we were being told this is what motherhood looks like, you know, the glossy magazine motherhood. But then we're also told, get back to work. You need to be able to do it all and be this powerhouse of a woman who can just manage all that. But luckily, quite earlier on, I sort of just learned to say, you know, it's not happening, sod it, and just not really care and stop reading all those articles. So.
Well, I guess that's a self-preservation strategy as well, kind of curating what information comes in front of your eyes. So stop reading those articles. It's a really big stance that a lot of people wouldn't necessarily see. They wouldn't see as like, is this other thing that is a pressure on me? They would see that it's this inner thing within me that is the problem because I'm not measuring up, I'm failing, rather than acknowledging that, oh, this other stuff is, that's the thing that's crap.
Yeah. And actually, it's when you start sort of fighting back against that. And I remember being at a baby group and sort of I didn't know the people that well. And everyone was sort of talking about how great things were or sort of the baby's food they'd made the day before. And I just someone was like, oh, how are you getting on? I just remember saying, crap, I feel like crap. The kids won't sleep. Obviously, I'm rubbish at motherhood because everyone else seems to manage. And I just thought I was crap at mumming. But one by one, like I remember this other lady went, oh, my God. Yeah, it is actually hard, isn't it? So I think once that lie starts to become uncovered, people feel more comfortable to say the same.
What happened for you then? You started being vulnerable and honest about how crap it was for you. What happened for you together with those other mums?
That's, I think, what sort of also sparked off the idea of the book and stuff. I felt more connected to them. I've always felt like a bit of an outsider before because I would just hear all the conversations going on and I just felt out of place, like I wasn't doing it correctly. It was a bit of a light bulb moment to realise that actually not everyone's doing brilliantly. Some people are just really good liars.
Yeah. And that's a very powerful thing that I remember early on as well, that one of my best friends, who was the only one who I could speak honestly about this, I was sending your clips to, he was saying, you do know that it's a thing, right? That people lie about how much their baby sleeps. As a psychologist, I was like, no. So I'm looking into this. And the research does show that up to, I think, 57% or something of people have lied about whether their child sleeps through the night.
Yeah, it's kind of like from speaking to other women, they think they're failing somehow if they're, you know, it's something they're doing wrong. And I actually found it quite sad in a way that people were that insecure and cared about what people think that they felt the need to lie about something, because obviously I didn't lie about it. I told the whole internet about my baby's bad sleeping. But yeah, I don't think it would have crossed my mind to lie. But if you actually look really into why these women are lying, it all stems back to what we were saying about the pressure to be perfect and everything that was surrounding them. And perhaps they were sort of embarrassed and ashamed that they weren't living up to those images.
Because if we think of that being seen as a societal pressure for women in motherhood to be perfect, and there would be their responsibility to make the baby sleep, which is, you and I both know that's not how it works. So you can do all the things, and if they don't sleep, it's not within our control. it can be really hard then, because that a personal failing, then obviously if I admit that, then that would be shameful. So no wonder that shame that leads to us hiding, and lying means we're covering things up. So for me, I never really kind of got that. And I just sought out the right people for me who resonated. Did you find that as well? Did you find your people?
Yeah, I think I did. I mean, when I was really ill, I wasn't really going out a lot. I was stuck in a bit of a bubble, but I did get a charity called Home Start. They really helped me out, and they kind of eventually persuaded me to go along to these parent and baby groups. And I think there, finally, I found people that weren't pretending everything was perfect. And yeah, I think when it came to sort of making really sort of firm friends, it was probably not till later. I just find it took me a while, actually, to find. I mean, there's plenty of nice mums out there that I came across and met. But I think those connections, I was too busy with two under two for a long time to sort of, yeah, I came later, actually, when they started like preschool and stuff, and you could start to have a few more chats.
That must have been so hard, though, juggling two under two when they didn't sleep and you were on your knees struggling with postnatal depression. And you've also mentioned that you have OCD. Do you want to talk a bit more about that?
Back then, I hadn't even been diagnosed with it. I just thought I was a massive weirdo. It's not the obvious. I wasn't washing my hands all the time. I mean, I wash my hands a lot anyway, to be fair, but not in an OCD way. I wasn't sort of doing light switches, like all the stuff we think we know about it. So it didn't even cross my mind that was what I had. I was doing behaviours to keep everyone safe that I thought was, you know, wearing certain clothes or doing, I'd have these chants, I would do, it sounds really weird, and things like that, and intrusive thoughts all the time, which is what now I can see that was probably a part of the postnatal anxiety, because I was, you know, I was convinced that the neighbours were going to come and kill my baby. I don't know why, they were perfectly nice, but because it was crying at night, I was like, they're going to flip, they're going to come round, and like it would grow and grow, and I couldn't control it. And the more ill I was, the more I couldn't control it. So I've sort of had it over the years, and whenever times are difficult, it does sort of flare up, and I find myself having to do so many things to make sure everyone is safe. When I went to see a psychiatrist, a psychologist, what we call them, they finally diagnosed me and gave me, I did some CBT around it, and it was really, really helpful. So now it flares up, but I can sort of remember she gave me lots of tools to try and stop going back into it. Because it's weird, because when you do, obviously you know this for your job probably, when you're doing those behaviours to keep you from feeling anxious, it sort of calms you down. So it's weird, but the only way I could sort of solve it was to stop doing them. So I'd have to go through a period of feeling anxious, oh god, I haven't done that or said that, everything's gonna go wrong. But my therapist was really funny, because I was like worried about saying stuff in case it jinxed things. She was like, oh, what, must be nice to be as powerful as you and be able to control the universe like that. I was like, what do you mean? She was like, can you say that we'll win the lottery on Saturday and see if you can make that work too? And she was like, it sounds a bit harsh, but which she was, it kind of, that really worked for me. I think she'd seen kind of blunt talk would help. I just suddenly thought, actually, she was like, why should it only work about bad things if you've got this power to change things by keeping your computer in a certain place or whatever weird things I did. So yeah, so that was a real eye-opener, just thinking, actually, yeah, if that was actually all true, I'd be so powerful. I'd be, you know.
Yeah, you'd will things on simply by the sheer of your thinking. I guess that it's within, for anyone who doesn't know enough about OCD to understand this, this is sort of when we assign a lot of importance and meaning to our thoughts. So like the fact that I've had this thought pop in, it means something. And in your case, it meant that you worried about harm, like harm coming or on things being unsafe. So this example you're giving is a very common strategy in CBT for OCD, where we kind of go flip, like slightly, she was quite flippant this one, but it sounds like that was really what you needed. And so a good therapist would obviously kind of like know the audience, suss out the dance floor. And it sounds like it was really helpful for you to kind of go flipping it on its head. And like, actually, if I was able to control things, I could also will on winning the lottery. And I've done that exercise with clients. It's really powerful when we realize that I can't prevent bad things from happening any more than I can make sure that good things happen either. It's really hard. But it sounds like also you're describing the kind of postnatal anxiety that is possibly less known than postnatal depression can take the form of intrusive thoughts. And I have interviewed people before on this podcast, like Caroline Boyd, about intrusive thoughts and maternal OCD and maternal rage. So anyone who wants to listen back to Caroline Boyd can do so. I'll pop that in the link in the show notes, because I think it's very powerful that you were able to be honest about that and share how that impacted you. And now that you sort of understand that reducing those behaviors doesn't necessarily reduce the anxiety immediately, and that can be like a hard trade-off. So why would anyone do that if it kind of quote-unquote works to reduce the anxiety? Why do we let go of these behaviors of checking or arranging our furniture or doing these sort of magical thinking things? What was in it for you to let go of those behaviors?
I don't know, because it took a while because of the things you just said. Like, my brain was saying, well, it's not doing any, you know, any harm. I'm not a Christian or anything, but I used to have these prayers that I would say. So it made no sense to me. But she had said, like, this is one thing you need to cut out. And in my head, I was like, well, they're not doing any harm, these little sort of prayer things I say at night that I've been doing for absolutely years. So I didn't understand sort of where she was coming from. And I even considered, I was like, well, if I actually become a Christian and go to church, then it won't be an OCD thing. It will be a proper prayer. So I was like trying to arguing with her. I was like, I think I'm just going to be a Christian. You know, that's how strong this urge was to do these things. I was like, well, I'm just going to go and start going to church. Then it won't be a behavior. It will be an actual thing about God. But obviously that didn't happen. And it was only when I'd sort of forced myself to stop these things that weirdly the anxiety started to reduce in everything, even day-to-day stuff. I hadn't realized how badly it was making my anxiety doing all these things every day.
And that's the paradox of it, isn't it? Because there's sort of initially you might make the anxiety worse, but the longer term, when we have cut out these checking behaviors, because checking feeds doubt, and checking makes the anxiety overall go up. So when we slowly, gradually kind of cut these out, and one of the terms for this is exposure with response prevention, you're prevented from doing the response you would normally do, then the anxiety starts to diminish and it's no longer controlling your life. Because if it's making you contemplate, do I pick up a religious faith? Then it's kind of like one of these things you pick up off the shelf in Tesco's, right? Then that started to impact your life, the quality of life. And I'm sorry to pop the bubble as well, because I've treated OCD in both like Muslims, Christians and Jews. And religious prayer is very different to OCD praying, because it's much more about the magical thinking. And I have worked with religious leaders like imams and priests about understanding the difference. And even it's the repetition of it in OCD that, like, I have to repeat it a certain number of times in order to prevent bad things from happening. So all the major religions obviously have ways of doing prayer, and OCD is very different to that. So anyone who's listening who does have faith as well, be conscious of that, and it's not quite the same thing.
So if ever that comes back into my head, I'll be like, yeah, it probably won't.
Yeah, be reminded of that. Like, if you work your way through the world religions, and then think it twice. It will be time consuming for not the right reasons, right? But Emily Jane, I know we kind of been a bit flippant, because that's the whole beauty of you, is that you use humor as a way to cope with really dark things. And at times we can be flippant. Let's think about two parts of that question. When does humor serve you well? What has it given to you? And when does it not serve you so well? When does it hinder you? So we start with our first one. It's like, what does it open up for you to use humor?
To use humor can almost, like, if I'm really angry about something or really sad, it almost, I think, it can distance you from the pain slightly. And obviously that's not going to be helpful to do that all the time. But if you're really stuck in that place where you can't come out, I think by sort of trying to somehow find something funny about it. And I honestly don't think there's much you can't, it could, you know, the darkest things like death, illness, everything, I think somehow you can normally find a sort of something funny in it, as weird as it sounds, as long as you're not making fun of someone else, if it's sort of about you. So I find that helpful as a distancing thing, and sometimes it can give you a bit of clarity.
Hello, busy working women. I've got news for you. There is a way where you can burn bright without burning out. There is a way where you can discover how to calm the overwhelm and create more ease and peace in your work and in your life. I want you to watch the replay of my free masterclass for ambitious female entrepreneurs, founders, CEOs, senior corporate women. And if you're wanting to create more impact in the world,
with less impact on yourself, this talk is for you. So let me see if this resonates with you. You're an ambitious female entrepreneur working hard to reach your goals, but it's taking a toll on your well-being. You can't remember the last time you properly switched off on a holiday without worrying about your business or the work to-do list. Your body is telling you to slow down, but you've got too much to do to listen, so you push through with more coffee or sugar. You worry about what other people think, or you second guess your decisions, or procrastinate something until it's perfect. Well then, this talk is for you. Let's find you balance over burnout so you can reach your stretchy goals without becoming overstretched. Go to thethomasconnection.lpages.co/burnbright. That's thethomasconnection.lpages.co/burnbright to catch this free replay of my masterclass. I'll put the link in the show notes as well, so it's just easier for you to click it and watch it in your own time. And now back to the episode.
And obviously laughing releases endorphins and is just a really healthy thing to do. So if I can make myself laugh, it can help lessen my mood. And a lot of the time I'll write funny little scripts or a funny poem about something I'm feeling. And by the time I've kind of finished it, I am feeling calmer. So I wrote a sketch for the Match Report about, I was in really bad mood when I wrote it, about women, you know, I can't say it because it's swearing, it's a sort of F off, say women type thing. I was just getting really stressed. I think I was trying to do some work and everything seemed to be against me. I couldn't do this right. I couldn't do that right. But then you should do this. So from a really bad mood, and I was literally really just writing for myself, as you know, it ended up on the TV. So sometimes good things can come out of you. And it can also, again, like we sort of touched upon how it can, yeah, actually bring people together. If something horrible happens and you sort of tell someone about it, but you can somehow find something to laugh at in it, I think it's an easier way of then them sort of connecting and saying, oh, that happened to me and I didn't look at it like that. And then you can sort of share a joke together.
I think it's like what I'm hearing is partly that it's a way to process for you to get space, perspective, space between you and the thing. Because when it's made it down on paper, when you've written down a funny angle of it, then it's no longer just right in here, kind of drowning you. And also a way to release it then, to kind of like, oh, now that's made it from your head onto TV, then it's no longer just your own demon. It's like a demon we can all share, right?
The time is just absolute bollocks in my diary by my bed, I have to say. It's not, yeah, unfortunately it doesn't always work out that way, but yeah, it is definitely a distancing thing and obviously a coping mechanism as well.
Absolutely. So it takes the edge off it, but also it's that sense of shared laughter, that it's a communal thing now. Like your inner demon has now become a public demon that other people can enjoy as well. Like sharing is caring, right? So taking all your inner darkness and putting that somewhere else, and other people be like, oh yeah, I also have that. That's sort of a shared experience, like your first book was illustrating. And using that sort of edge to it and making fun of it means it's sort of, it doesn't hold the same power over you anymore. That lightness comes out.
That's a really good way to describe it. It stops it having the power, you know, those desperate feelings.
It does. And if that is your access point into being more compassionate and laughing at it and laughing with yourself, I think that's a very big difference between, say, being self-deprecating and being really mean to yourself and sort of ripping a new one in yourself. So I guess kind of coming to the second part of that question, when is it less helpful? When is humor hindering you or not helping your process?
I think only when I get too caught up in doing that, I use it as avoidance to actually, yeah, to avoid dealing with the particular issue. You can sort of go too far if I think, right, I'm just going to do that. And I'll, you know, write little comedy things about something that's actually happening and then realize I haven't actually dealt with the thing. And even when I tell other people the story of this sort of sad thing that's happened, I tell it as the funny story. And then I'll have a bit of a breakdown and realize, oh God, I haven't actually dealt with this. I've just been sort of laughing about it. So yeah, I have to sort of watch out for that sometimes. If it's something I really don't want to think about or deal with, sometimes you do just need, unfortunately, to have a good cry or to be a bit sad for a while.
Yeah. And what do you do to distinguish between whether it's approach, like asking, it's helping me to approach the problem, kind of process it, release it, let go of it, versus when it's avoidance, it's helping me distance myself from it, not face it, and like mask it with the humor. Well, how do you know the difference between the approach and the avoid?
I would love to say I have learned how to suss this out by now, but normally it's because I've been bottling it up. It'll come out in, I would just burst into tears or have a really bad panic attack. Or actually it's manifested itself because I haven't dealt with this sort of horrible thing inside me. It's come out physically, like I'll suffer from this horrible ear pain sometimes that's sort of unbearable. So it sometimes manifests as that. So I'd love to say I'd sussed out, but it's not. Sometimes I can think, do you know what? Probably just need to actually fake, but more often than not, I'm afraid I still haven't I still haven't learned the way to realize before I've broken, sort of thing.
In a way, I'm very grateful that that was the answer, because sometimes we can give this image that, especially people who are more in the public space or have a platform, an audience of any kind, we can kind of make it seem like we have just done all the things and know which exactly what button to press in what order. And it gives this image of perfection again, rather than kind of like, well, the image of humanity, which is, oh, I messed it up again. And that kind of happens, that we are not robots, and you still have the brain that you have. And it might be that every single time this happens, it's something like another rinse of the washing machine, that it's like, oh, maybe I shouldn't put it on the highest cycle next time. Sometimes we learn from that, sometimes we implement that, and sometimes we get it royally wrong, you know?
That's true, actually. And I think we are all still learning these things. And there's other stuff about mental health. I can feel when I'm sort of slipping down, and I can recognize those sort of signs when I feel like the OCD thing's seeping in. And I can go and do things I know will help with that. Go for a walk, do more exercise, talk to people and things. Like you say, it's not a straightforward journey. And I think the more we sort of grow and get to know ourselves, it sounds silly like our age, but you do, and get to know what triggers these things, the better we'll get. But I'm not there all the way yet.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that this is something that still comes up in waves, where it gets very troublesome and kind of needing to kind of come back to it and use the tools to help you with the OCD or the anxiety. And I wish there was, I mean, it's a heartfelt wish I have for anyone I've ever worked with, that I would get them to a point where I lift this off them and then never troubles them again. Like the black dog is now forever banished. But unfortunately, we do know that reality of it is that relapse is very common. Not always. If we have a successful treatment, we can kind of keep relapse at the door. But it's because we usually have to do things to keep it at the door as well, like maintaining the tools and using the strategies we've learned. Sometimes we slip, and then I think it's about bringing it back. So, you know, we talked about using humor and being funny to, as a way to process. And so you've written two very different books. Your second book that just, well, you recently came out. Tell us a little bit more about that. How did you decide to write a funny children's book? So the book is called The Beast of Knobbly Bottom, Attack of the Vampire Sheep. How did you decide to write about that?
One reason was because I promised my children I would write something without swearing in it, because obviously they're too young to watch most of the stuff I've written. When they were really small, I caught one of them trying to take my Sleepers for the Week book, which even in the title, it's like how to survive when your children won't go the F to sleep. And it's got lots of swearing in it. So I caught them trying to take it to show and tell. And I was like horrified. I was like, oh no, you're teaching them what they think, grabbed it back off them. So I kind of had promised for years I would write them something they could take to show and tell and they could read themselves. Also, I love reading to them. I've loved reading them funny stories. So just since I discovered how many brilliant sort of kids' books that were out there, and they're so fun now, they have a much better selection than we had at that age. I was just like, I would love to do this. And I always have liked writing silly stories anyway. Like all my notebooks as a child are all just these silly stories about things. Always love an excuse for a bum joke. And, you know, they go down a lot better with children. So, yeah, I thought,
I love bums and farts. It's hilarious.
Exactly. You can't beat it. And obviously, it's part of the desperate quest to make my children laugh with a Knobbly Bottom book. So, yeah. And it has always something I've wanted to do. But it's just fine, as always, finding the time in between work, in between kids, in between all this that gets in the way. I applied for an Arts Council grant, actually, I think it's like sort of a DYCP, develop your own creative practice. So if you're in the creative world and you want to sort of change a bit of direction. So I applied for them, not expecting to get it because it's really hard. And so they just gave me enough so I could take a few months. I could cut back a bit on my freelance work. And so I sort of paid myself a little wage to do that. So that was a few years ago. So thanks to that, I was able to get the draft together.
So where would people find information about that if there's anyone who's thinking about the same to apply for that?
I mean, the form is a long-winded pain in the bum, but it's worth it. And I think I got turned down the first time, but just keep bugging them until they do. Yeah, just on the Arts Council website, obviously there's the normal grants for sort of big projects and stuff if you're, say, a theatre company and things, but they also have this develop your own creative practice. I definitely recommend having a go. If you are a creative and you just want a bit of a change of direction, they will actually give you kind of, a couple of grand to so you can sit down and pay yourself a little wage to do it.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Because one of the things that we obviously know, you and I know, that writing books does not make you rich, even when you have a book deal, unless you are absolutely huge and you've already made a name for yourself. So you get a contract that gives you that, then it's not lucrative.
Even really successful authors can't, apart from people like J.K. Rowling's success. But I mean, you see some other people got loads of books out. I'm like, oh God. But actually the reality is they probably still aren't earning a great deal. So yeah, most of us have to have another job as well, don't we?
So that says a lot about still having that passion and that drive to keep going with it, to persist in writing a book. And I've sort of often said that book writing is one of those funny things that there's such a delay in the gratification and you have to keep working.
Even after you've written it and it's sort of you've done all the edits and everything like that and the book's come out, you've still got to keep promoting it. You've still got to keep plugging away. And while it's nice, it's like, yeah, no other job would you kind of be that delayed. It's just, if you love writing, it's worth it, I guess, in the end.
And that sense of going from a funny non-fiction book, in a sense, well, talking about sleep, to then talking about storytelling. Like, what is The Beast of Knobbly Bottom about? Why would people need to read that one?
Just to have a little giggle, really. It's about a little girl called Maggie, who moves from the city to a little village called Knobbly Bottom, and she absolutely hates it. She thinks it's so boring and she just wants to move back to Leicester, which is where they were from. But then weird things start happening. She meets some really weird characters, a bit like warning her off. I can't remember that weird town out of The League of Gentlemen, a bit like a children's version of that. They go into the local shop and they're all like, no, you're not local. So it's all weird. And then obviously clues in the title, the sheep are a bit weird, turn out to be vampires. She ends up making friends with some of these weird people and they have to battle them out. But I really wanted to make a book that was fun for parents to read out loud to their kids, having spent probably half my life reading stories to my sleep-hating kids who are always like, one more chapter, one more book. Which is fine, but the joy of when you find a book that you can laugh along with them and you can do those funny voices and there's little in-jokes. I remember reading the Mr. Gum books. I absolutely loved them. They were just made me laugh. I mean, it's great there are books that deal with sort of issues these days for kids, but I think when I read those, I was like, I don't have to. I can just make people laugh, like kids and parents laugh, and that's fine. I think that held me back from starting a book, actually, because I thought, I need an issue or something. Is this kid going to have something wrong? What am I going to deal with? And I was like, actually, just going to be silly and write some bum jokes. And, there's a lot of girl power type stuff in there as well, which I really wanted to make. I didn't want the mum character as a mum myself to sort of just be the typical background, like two-dimensional carer, getting the dinner ready and stuff like that. I wanted her to have jokes and be part of the action as well. So I really take issue with the phrase dad jokes because mums are just as funny as dads and they can make just as rubbish jokes as them.
Absolutely. We buy into that a lot. We have whole decks of funny jokes and I crack as many of those crap ones as my husband does. And it's,
exactly. We need to rebrand it because I know it's supposed to be sort of a bit rubbishy jokes, but the kids like that kind of thing. So actually they're good jokes. So yeah, let's rebrand parent jokes from now on.
Yeah, absolutely. Or just people who are just a little bit rubbish and don't take themselves too seriously. So those kind of parent jokes are the ones when you reach a certain age and you drop these funny jokes. They do make the kids laugh. And I remember seeing somewhere that Julia Donaldson, who's obviously one of the most loved children's authors of the UK, would say that if she's up for an award and she's any of the other people in the lineup are writing anything about bums or farts, she knows she's not going to win.
Oh my God, that's so true. Do you know what? When I first went around promoting this book, Knobby Bottom, I was going around lots of schools and stuff, and I'd written this speech, the talk I was going to do with all these carefully crafted jokes in. The first time I did it, all those jokes I thought were hilarious, these clever jokes, just met with silence. But as soon as I literally said the word bum or poo, didn't even have to sort of do it in any clever way, I would have them in stitches. I was like, oh my God. Literally, I was overthinking it so much.
Simplicity is key when it comes to children, I think.
Anything like that. So yeah, so I learned as I went along what Julia Donaldson was saying, the kids can't get enough. And actually, I find it, like you were saying, I think some of us have just got that sense of humour and never kind of grow out of it.
I find it hilarious as well. And it's anything that helps to end the day on a point of connection, because it's a shared laughter and you can make the silly voices. And I find myself that those bedtimes, when there's a good book where there's lots of different characters and voices, I want to know what happens in the next chapter. It's very different to like dragging yourself through something. And it sounds like you also do find a moral of the story. You did weave in something you're passionate and care about sort of wanting to have a female protagonist, wanting to have a multidimensional version of a mother. So without realizing, you're actually weaving that into it, even though you're sort of saying in a self-critical way maybe that, oh, I didn't write something that had substance. But there is substance there, right? How you think of the characters.
And I think that came from taking the pressure off myself, because I thought it needed to have a purpose, but it actually ended up having a purpose by relaxing into it. And there's sort of themes about motherhood in there and these kind of superpowers we get when we've got children. You know, you can suddenly get these bravery powers, as the mum calls it in the book. So yeah, I think by sort of letting go of this feeling it needed to have a purpose, it ended up somehow having things that were important to me anyway in there.
Interesting what happens when we reduce the pressure a little bit and then lower that expectation.
All down to that, but back to being like the perfectionism. I felt I needed to have this perfect book, so I didn't actually start it because I didn't have, you know, all these things I thought a children's book needed. Yeah, you're right. So it takes us back to where we started, really.
It does. And a kind of image of perfection in motherhood, in us as authors, in us as women, like it doesn't exist. But I guess we're kind of talking about the purpose. We've talked about the playfulness and holding things a little bit more lightly and using humor as a way to release. What about pause for someone who has perfectionistic tendencies, who is ambitious, who've actually not necessarily rags to riches, but climbed up from a dark place? Where does pause come in for you, Emily Jane?
I would say those times where I am struggling a bit and I'm tending to use distraction to, like we spoke about, to sort of dealing with it, that's when I know I need to pause. And the busier I am sometimes, the more I think, wait a minute, why am I making so I've never got just an hour to myself? I've got to kind of pause to get out for a walk or something like that. But also sometimes, especially when you work from home, I have my pause could sometimes look different to someone else's. Like I sometimes want to pause from my own brain, so a pause for me might be arranging to meet some friends socially who, you know, make me laugh, just to get out of myself and talk to other people. So I think sometimes I can do that, but yeah, it's normally when I'm busy, like normally with worky stuff or the kids thing, I think actually I do need to pause. But do I really want to pause and just listen to my own stupid brain again? I want to go and actually pause in some noise and see people. So
that's a really, really quite wise way of approaching it, though, to kind of think what's going to be helpful right now. And we don't have to be prescriptive of that. So pausing must look like this, must be seated meditations in stillness. If the function of it is to actually get out of your own mind, do whatever works to do that, that isn't harmful to yourself or other people. And connecting socially would kind of mean that, oh, actually, I'm now pulled out of this and connecting to the present moment a bit more, being with them. So whatever works. I've heard so many different variations of what pause looks like for people, that there is no hard and fast rule that this is what it needs to look like. So it's really helpful that you've shared that. And kind of tying the conversation to an end, bringing it to a close, I often ask the guests if they have a permission they want to give the listeners or a pressure they want to take off them. What would that be?
if I had that power, to give people permission to laugh at things, even if they think it's not really funny. Just don't feel bad about it. Doesn't belittle what you're going through. Just try and let yourself laugh about it. And yeah, just generally to stop, just take the pressure off in general to live up to the expectations either you had of yourself or society kind of has.
Thank you so much for coming on and talking about The Beast of Lovely Bottom, Sleep is for the Weak, and your very vulnerable account of your journey into motherhood. So thank you so much for sharing this. If people want to go and find out more about you, you know, where do you hang out on Instagram?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram at Emily Jane Little Line, whatever it's called, Clark, or I've got a website, emilyjaneclark.com.
So good to chat to you, and people can go and order your books for a little laugh, either for themselves or for their kids. So thank you so much for being a fantastic guest today.
No, thanks for having me. It's been lovely.
Thank you for listening to the end of this episode. I know your time is precious, and I am really grateful that you've dedicated it to this. I'm hoping that it also gave you something. Maybe you chuckled along a little bit. Maybe you were thinking, like I did, that it is so much nicer to let go of some of the seriousness around some of these topics, so that we also have the space, the capacity, the tenacity to keep doing hard things in relation to these hard things, like coping with motherhood or little sleep, or dealing with mental health problems like anxiety, depression, or OCD. So if you are someone who has been affected by OCD, or you know someone who's suffering from this condition, make sure to ask for support. You can access free help from the NHS through Improving Access to Psychological Therapies, or IAPT, I-A-P-T, either by looking up your local IAPT service in your area by Googling IAPT, or asking your GP for a referral into psychological therapies. Don't wait. OCD is something that doesn't tend to get better on its own and might need intervention. If you prefer to have a private option where you can control who you choose as your provider of support, please know that me and my team also are trained and experienced in treating OCD as well. So if you need to have a chat about this, do reach out to us on info@thethomasconnection.co.uk. Also, lastly, listen to the episode with Caroline Boyd about intrusive thoughts in motherhood. It's really important to speak about this because it can feel really frightening, really scary to have these unwanted intrusive thoughts about even seeing images of things that are horrific to you and think that you might act on them. Thinking about things doesn't mean you're going to act on them. There's a big difference. So listen to that episode as well to learn more about OCD. And until I speak to you next time, I do hope that you can take care of yourself, that you give yourself a break and you have some fun. This is exactly what I do in Burnbright as well. We use a sense of humour and lightness so that we also have the capacity to sit with the darker things too. Doors are open to Burnbright. If you want to apply to have a spot on the group coaching program, you can reach out to me again on info@thethomasconnection.co.uk.
Thank you so much for listening to the end of this episode of the Pause, Purpose, Play podcast with me, Michaela Thomas. If you found this episode helpful, make sure that you hit that follow or subscribe button to not miss the next episode. Tell other people about this podcast because together we can change the world and be more kind, caring and compassionate to ourselves as well as other people. And as always, do take care of yourself. Until I see you next week.